right, if you've got part two all queued up, go ahead and hit play now. And this section here is an homage to a short film I made called Play Dead, which was filmed in this same kitchen, actually, and starts with a shot that is nearly identical to this one right here. And again, this is all about Jack trying to feel something. That's why he sits across from her. That's why he stares at the wedding ring. He's just trying to feel bad or disgusted about what they've done here, and, you know, he just can't. And that's why there's that defeated shrug of the shoulders. I'm not sure we totally sell that idea, but that was the intention. Batman's gonna show up here in a second, and what I wanted to say the first time he showed up that I totally forgot about was, you know, we don't have the most expensive bat suit. We sort of shot around its limitations. Sometimes I think the emphasis gets placed on all the wrong things, particularly in fan films. You know, people will blow thousands of dollars on costumes and load the thing up with CGI and think that'll, you know, sort of hide the fact that they didn't spend that much time on the script. But I've always felt that, like, if you have an engaging story and characters, your audience will forgive a lot, and that should be your first priority. That's the foundation you want to build your film on, a story that excites you, and not the latex suit that you found on eBay. And, you know, hey, I'm not trying to say we made a perfect movie, you know, not even close. And I'm not saying that I'm not proud of the suit that we did put together, because we worked really hard on it. You know, the point is, I didn't let the fact that we didn't have tons of money to spend on it stop me from making the movie. You know, and if there's one thing that you take away from this commentary, if you're an aspiring filmmaker, you can find reasons to talk yourself out of doing everything. You can always make excuses. There will always be obstacles. There's always going to be this little voice inside your head whispering all the reasons that you can't do something. Don't listen to it. Where there's a will, there's a way. And all you need is the desire to tell a story. Filmmaking should not be some elitist thing for people that can afford all the high-end equipment. You know, that's like saying you need a brand new laptop if you want to be a writer. Will it make it easier? Yeah, it absolutely. And does it give you more options? Sure. But is it essential? No way. I mean, your limitations will force you to be more creative. And I fully support the technology when it allows you greater freedom in how you tell your story and more options, you know, that way. But I can't stand when it takes the place of a story. I think there was no audio. For some reason, the mic cut out when we shot that scene of Eddie getting stabbed. And so his grunts and, you know, his sort of, you know, his surprise when he sees the tally man, I had to pull those sound effects from somewhere else. That's not actually Ryan. Eddie's death it's much more graphic in the script. But we shot Tommy's death before this one, and I was worried. Actually, this was one of the last things. This was the second to last week of shooting. And so I was sort of afraid that we'd gone slightly overboard in other places with the violence, and I pulled back on this. And looking at it now, I think that was a mistake. This is my least favorite death scene. And not that it, you know, needed to be gorier, although, to be honest, I don't think it would have hurt if there was a little more blood. It's just the execution of it in general is a little disappointing to me. I wish we'd shot it the way we originally planned to. Plus, there's that shot of the tally man running when he slashes Eddie's arm. He's supposed to have this limp. It's part of his backstory. Maybe it was the adrenaline. I don't know. But, you know, there's no limp. I'm sort of pissed I didn't notice that, but it was the end of, like, a 16-hour day, and I know I just wasn't at the top of my game. Okay, so I gotta talk about Batman's boots again. In addition to being terribly unsafe, they also click, like women's high heels. Not very intimidating. So any scene of Batman where he's walking and you can hear the boots, every footstep had to be taken out and replaced in post-production. We should have just covered the bottom of them with something to keep them from making any noise at all. I don't know, maybe in the next one Batman will just wear socks. In this moment here, when I wrote the script, I imagined the Tallyman being hidden among all the pipes and the furnace and all this, you know, machinery in the basement. Sort of like in the original Alien movie, where the alien's on the shuttlecraft with Ripley and you don't realize it's there until it turns its head. But we got to the location and realized that that wasn't going to work, so sometimes you got to compromise. And what we did here instead is still sort of a neat effect. So now's a good time to mention our fight choreographer, Victor. He came in at the last second and just totally saved us. He's really talented, really creative, and just the nicest guy. Any day he was on set with us was immediately made better just by his presence. I'd never shot a straightforward action scene in any of my other movies, and you'll notice in the script all of the fights are written so vague because I figured whatever the choreographer helped come up with would be a million times better than anything I could write. This is not a good approach. I don't recommend doing that. It created more work for us to do when we got into choreography with the actors, and it created a lot of anxiety when it came time to film this stuff, and I ended up shooting way more footage than I needed to because I was so nervous. We started working with the actors about a month before shooting, which really was not a lot of time. And then when we shot, you know, each fight, we broke it down into segments, figured out which angles we were going to use for each segment. And now having edited this, I have a much better understanding of how to shoot a fight scene than I did going into this blindly. And this thing with the Tallyman stabbing Eddie's bullet hole and flinging the blood in Batman's eyes. Originally, this scene took place outside. It was all going to happen in that alley where Jack and Eddie start arguing. So the Tallyman throws dirt or gravel or something in Batman's eyes. Well, obviously, we're in a basement now, and that's not going to work. So I can't remember who came up with this, but I wasn't sure. I thought maybe this was pushing it. But Charlie really wanted to do it. It was probably his idea. And it works. It's gross, but it works. And because we switched the location, most of the Tallyman's murders now take place in a basement. It's a cautionary tale. Kids, stay out of basements. They're bad news. This is Emma Harris playing Rebecca Drake. Her and Dan are a couple in real life. She tagged along on his audition, and Kristen asked if she'd like to audition too. So they read a scene together. This scene, actually. And there was never going to be better chemistry between two actors than with these two. This was the first night of shooting. And I remember Emma asking me if Rebecca knew that Tim used to be Robin. For several reasons, I let her decide that for herself, but my opinion is that no, she doesn't know. And this is the only glimpse we get of their life together before, you know, everything goes south, so it's a short scene, but a really important one. One of the things I really like about Dan's performance is you shoot these scenes, and, you know, you're obviously very attentive, but sometimes, you know, you just don't really see all the subtleties until you're editing. And as you cut and paste certain takes together, you begin to notice things you didn't notice before. And one of the things Dan did was he put this sort of quiet insecurity into Tim. This idea that he's trying to step out of Batman's shadow and be his own man and maybe isn't completely pulling it off. And it's a tough thing to do, you know, to have this chip on your shoulder and still be a sympathetic character. Anytime we're on Dan in this scene, that's still the first night of shooting. Anytime it's on Batman, that's weeks later. We had to reshoot all that stuff. And the reason we were able to do that, the reason these guys are never in the same frame, except when Batman looks through the door at the end, is to emphasize the fact that they're in two different worlds now, you know, that there's this disconnect between them, and just trying to play that up aesthetically. You know, I think this is Tim's story in a lot of ways. You know, especially, again, if you've read that prequel that's on the website, I think he has the most identifiable character arc, and he's the most accessible point of connection for an audience. Batman, to me, feels like part of the ensemble. That's the way it was written. But it really wound up being Tim's movie, and Dan's a big part of that. I think there's a great deal in this film that works based solely on him. He's also really good at taking dialogue that could be silly in the hands of another actor and making it work. So it was also another night that we were dealing with the L. It ran right behind this apartment. And I mean right behind it. There was also a thunderstorm when we first started and this renegade cricket who wouldn't shut up. And I mean, so you talk about diving in head first. It's the first day of shooting, so I'm already a wreck. And it's another example. I mean, same as the other scene with the train, where we talked about it. We considered looking for another location, but again, this was my favorite. So it looks identical to how I pictured it when I wrote it. As filming went on, we got better and better at putting Charlie in this costume. Well, Kristen did, I should say. She's the one who did his makeup and helped him get into all that stuff. Eventually, they could do it in like 10 minutes, but this first night, you know, it took over an hour. But it was a pretty incredible moment, you know, to have Batman walk onto the set. And it's when you realize, you know, holy crap, here we are, we're doing this, we're making a Batman movie. And when, you know, he gets up here and looks through the door at them, we're just trying to have a vulnerable moment for him here. You know, Batman has a tendency to stay largely the same from the start of a story to the end. There aren't a lot of earth-shattering revelations here, you know, for him. In fact, the events of the movie really only reaffirm what he already believes, that he has to be alone, it's too risky to involve other people. He tries to warn Tim, but Tim has to learn the hard way. So the idea was always that Batman doesn't push people out because he doesn't care. It's because he does. And so even though his character arc isn't as defined or as obvious, you know, as Tim's is, it is there. But because he's more of an understated character, you want to find a few small moments like that to help make him seem a little bit more human. Part of the reason we gave all the characters these, you know, little subplots like Baron and Candace having an affair and the thing with Jack is I didn't want the villains to be these nameless, forgettable henchmen, you know, cardboard cutouts that exist only to get beaten up by Batman. So even though they're not in a lot of scenes, I wanted them to seem identifiable when they were on screen. And when this stuff with where Baron catches Selina on the roof here, this was supposed to be the start of the next fight scene. Originally, they kind of duke it out before he takes her hostage. The main reason it was cut was that the Batman-Tallyman fight scene had just happened. There was already this action beat. It really seemed more important to keep the story moving here. I didn't want the fight scenes getting redundant. And there was some good stuff in there, and it was much longer than the other Baron and Selina fight at the end of the movie. I mean, it was a really tough decision, but yeah, it just felt like it had to go. So this interrogation room, what I remember most is that Shelley took a huge dump while we were in here. Oh, I should specify that Shelley is a cat. It's not like we had an unruly crew that would just drop a deuce whenever they got upset with you. No, Shelley's a cat. Her litter box was in this room. We had all the lights in there, tons of people crammed into this tiny space, no windows. It was really hot, and we're just sitting there marinating in the odor of this little masterpiece of hers. I think she waited for us to get in there, actually. She wanted to make sure we knew how she felt about us tearing up her home. So for me, this is the cat poop scene. I hope it doesn't hinder your enjoyment of it. Scott and Dan are both really great here. There's actually a lot of dialogue that got cut out of this scene as well, with Jack talking about how Thorne took him in when he was too young to know any better and he didn't know what he was getting into. Tells Tim that he wouldn't understand, but for Tim, it of course sounds exactly like what happened with him and Bruce. It was a nice moment, but it was affecting the pace, and I needed to keep the story on track, and so now they just get right down to business. You know, the thing that bothers me about cutting that fight scene is now it looks like Baron captures her effortlessly, and that kind of sucks. There's also this misconception that she is Catwoman in this movie. She's not. She slips into her old ways again, you know, piece by piece, but she's not officially Catwoman again until the very last shot of the film. So I know a lot of fans might be watching this and thinking that, you know, she's not tough enough, but this isn't Selina in her prime. She's retired the Catwoman persona. And of course, as the film goes on, I think you see her discovering that she never should have given it up because that's who she really is. And you know, if we do another one, you'll see a full-fledged Catwoman kicking ass and taking names, but this isn't that story. I love Renee's look here after she incriminates Baron and Candace. You know, she says something about the perfume, and then there's these looks all around. And then she just smiles and looks so completely satisfied with herself. There were there were a couple of subplots dropped from the film. You know, this was never intended to be feature length. It was supposed to emulate the feel of a 3 or 4 issue arc in the comics. But it wound up being longer than we thought it would. And if I could go back, I'd add another 20 or 30 minutes and make it feature length, because we certainly had material that was just dropped as subsequent drafts of the script were written. You know, material that would have pushed it into, you know, 90 minutes, 100 minutes. One of the main things that was lost was this idea that Batman couldn't go anywhere in the city without all these thugs taking shots at him, because everyone was trying to collect on Thorne's contract. And there was more with the media and the way they couldn't decide if Batman should be celebrated or condemned because of his suspected involvement in the deaths of these mobsters. So that was some of the first stuff to go in favor of telling a more specific and centralized story. So we're coming up on the flashback sequence. In addition to all of her behind-the-scenes work, Kristen also plays Jennifer here. I haven't even mentioned this yet. Kristen's also my girlfriend, so it's really nice when your producing partner lives with you and doesn't object to you tearing the place apart to build sets and costumes and props. I know a lot of guys will put their girlfriends in their movie just because, but I'd been trying to find a project to work on with Kristen way before we even started dating. I mean, when we were just friends. There she is. And this is just the way it worked out, that Batman was the first chance that we had to do that. This was also her first movie. She comes from a theater background as well. And there are obviously a lot of differences between stage and screen, so I know she was really nervous, and she's really hard on herself, but I think she does a great job. And I think her and Josh, who plays Vincent, I think they both communicate so much even when they're not speaking. And you have to give her credit, because this would be rough. You know, this is a difficult scene, I think, for any actress, and I was full of mixed emotions, you know, while we shot this, because on one hand, Harold is frightening and so intense, and I was really, you know, really excited by some of the footage we were getting. And then on the other hand, I was feeling really protective over Kristen and getting sort of angry at the way he had his hands all over her. So just making that separation, realizing everyone's a professional and taking the necessary steps to make sure we're not stepping over anyone's boundaries. You know, the idea behind this scene is we kind of want to change the way you look at the Tally Man. And not that you should be rooting for him after this, but, I mean, if we can achieve any level of sympathy for this character, then I think the scene is working. And this is another one I wasn't sure would make it into the film as written. You know, a pregnant woman being shot, that's pretty brutal. But the thing is, we've been watching the Tally Man do all these terrible things, and then when you see what these guys did to him, I think it becomes easier to understand why he's being so vicious. Because to me, he's not a bad guy, and that ambiguity is sort of what this movie's all about. It's one of the main themes. It's what the title refers to. Oh, the other thing is, this guy standing to the left of Scott, right there, that character is Anthony. And he's one of, you know, the one that the DJs are talking about in the opening, and the mob enforcer with ties to Thorne. And then later Eddie says something about Batman busting up the shipment down at the docks and fishing Anthony out of the water. So what's implied is that the Tally Man has killed him before the film has started. And again, if you read that prequel, you'll find out a little bit more about him. And I thought some people might be confused, though, if they hadn't been paying attention in the beginning. So that's who that is and why he's standing there. I think this was a rough shoot for Josh. Unfortunately, he was with us at the very beginning, and when I was still running around like a chicken with his head cut off, and we were still at a point where I was letting this project control me instead of the other way around. But he's obviously a very gifted actor, and this is such an important moment, and he completely nails it. We met a couple of times before filming. We were trying to figure out how the Tally Man moves and how he speaks, and it was Josh who said, "What if that last bullet hits him in the throat?" And he started doing that really raspy voice, and you know, it's like, that's it. So I have to give him credit for that. And these noises he makes here, it just makes this all so effective. There's a deleted scene that shows that Jennifer's the one who did this painting. Well, it's not deleted. It's when Vincent proposes, but now there's just this quick flash of it after Batman hands him the ring at the end. But in the full version, you see that it's, you see her working on this painting, which Kristen actually did herself. She painted that. And you see that that's why she has the Tallyman mask. You can see it hanging behind her. She's using it as a reference for this painting and explains why there's this canvas just chilling out in the center of the room. This moment coming up where Tim calls Batman, and he's already standing in Vincent's apartment. I remember getting to that scene when I was working on the script and thinking, well, Batman must have a way for people to reach him, you know? And in the comics, there's Oracle, who, you know, is connected to everybody and, you know, passing messages back and forth. But, you know, it's not like Batman's going to bust out a cell phone or a walkie-talkie or a carrier pigeon, carrier bat, I guess. So this idea of a receiver built into his cowl is, it's something you read in the comics and you never think twice about. And you put it in a movie and all of a sudden there's all these questions. Like, I mean, I guess we just assume that Tim has this number, the direct line to Batman's head. And presumably, you know, there's a silent setting on this device here, because that'd really suck if Batman were trying to sneak up on some bad guys and this thing starts going off. I don't know, maybe I'm the only one who gets hung up on stuff like this. We should do an alternate cut of this, where instead of the beeping, Batman's got a ringtone for his utility belt. Like a theme song from Curb Your Enthusiasm or something. When he starts pulling the pictures off and there's that message under all of them, it was tricky to edit, because I mean, I feel like as soon as he takes the first picture off, you know what it says, and then there's just this waiting game until Batman catches up. So I tried to, cut it down as best I could. Jack's death is noticeably different from the other death scenes in the movie. There's a couple of reasons for that. One of them is that we've already established the Tallyman as a threatening figure, I think. I mean, we've seen what he can do. We don't really need to be as graphic here. Mostly, though, it's that Tommy and Eddie both do pretty deplorable things before we see them get killed. So there's maybe a sense that they deserve what they get. I mean, not totally, but they're not especially decent people. And not that Jack is either. I just don't think the film ever paints him as being as vile as the other two. And, you know, we've just humanized the Tallyman for the audience, and you don't want to turn him into a monster again right away. So that's why Jack gets it quick, and why it's off-screen, and why we don't see the aftermath of it. There's just no reason to. We did try to give all the death scenes their own personality, their own feel. So, you know, showing the nails and not the mask. Which I kind of like, because having just seen the flashback, you know, I mean, maybe it's easier to picture Vincent standing there and not, you know, just the Tallyman. This sound effect for Tim's phone works a little too well. There have been a few times it gets to this part and everyone starts checking their pockets to see if it's their phone. There is another version of Tim coming home where he finds Baron holding his son. And then Baron sets the baby down and stomps on it. And, you know, Tim screams and runs over and realizes it's just a stuffed animal wrapped in the baby's blanket. And that's when Baron knocks him out and takes him prisoner. We just didn't have time to shoot it. I thought of it after we did this, and we were just never able to get everyone back to this location. I guess it's probably better heading into the climax to just keep it moving, but I really can't imagine anything worse than seeing your child in Baron's arms. It kind of bothers me that Baron drives a Saturn. Kristen's like, well, you know, he needs to be inconspicuous. I mean, it's not like I wanted him driving a monster truck or a hearse or something, but, you know, just not a Saturn. Oh well, you gotta use what you've got available to you, so. So there it is. And this was that first weekend of shooting. One of those really late nights. Alright, so that's two down and one to go, so it's time to move on to part 3.